second to last class I want to do today, we're going to do, hopefully, talk about Zionism, what's going on in Israel up until the War of Independence. In the last class, we're going to talk a little bit about, again, very brief overview of the last 50 years of the State of Israel, the major historical events, and then I'm going to just do a summary at the end for the second class. Okay, I wanted to begin with Theodor Herzl, who is certainly one of the people who you can't study Zionism without studying Herzl. As I mentioned before, Herzl didn't originate Zionism, but because of his circumstances, he is always associated as the major figure in the Zionist movement. I mentioned, we talked about the Dreyfus trial. I mentioned Herzl's name there. Herzl is actually originally born. He's born completely assimilated family. And he worked as a journalist. He's actually trained as a lawyer, but he worked as a journalist for the new Free Press in Austria. And of course, Austria at the time was a place that had a very large Jewish community and a very assimilated Jewish community. We already talked about the Reform Movement. This is one of the most westernized assimilated Jewish communities in the world. Herzl's dates, by the way, 1860 to 1904. He dies at age 44 of a heart attack. He's really one of the major, in my opinion, you know, he doesn't get great press in some circles of the Jewish people. I always refer to him as one of the real tragic figures of modern Jewish history. Tragic because he's a person who I don't think really ever understood what he was really was coming from. His total lack of Jewish background definitely left him sort of blind. But he's also a person, to be fair, who gave everything to the Jewish people in his own way. As ignorant as he may have been, he's a person who literally bankrupted himself and died very young because of his complete mesiris nefesh for his cause. He is really a very driven person, and his whole family is a tragedy. He married a woman, Julia, from a very rich Austrian Viennese family who is not Jewish. She had some sort of something in the family is not. We don't know exactly what, but for sure, like a Reform conversion, she wasn't halachically Jewish. There's definitely some scandal involved in his marriage. So his kids aren't even Jewish. His family is a disaster from beginning to end. We talk about after his death, I'll talk what happened to the rest of his family. You can see what a tragedy is. But Herzl's big reawakening, being someone who is completely unaffiliated, is of course the Dreyfus trial in 1894. And as I mentioned before, he was shocked to see that the crowd is shrieking, "Death to Jews." And he came to this realization. And he had contemplated previously, actually, early on in Herzl's career, there's actually, you know, this idea that he had even thought about the idea of the solution to anti-Semitism was the mass conversion of Jews. This is before the Dreyfus trial. And he had some very, again, coming from no real Jewish background, not a large amount of Jewish pride here. But what the Dreyfus trial is definitely a watershed in Herzl's life, realizing that the Jew will not be accepted into European society. And he goes on to write a book called Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, which becomes, and it's very interesting, you should get a copy of the book and read it. It's very interesting to read his, because he has these sort of fictional, idyllic descriptions, like of, you know, Jews sailing on the Dead Sea and the industry, and some of which actually has come true, which is quite interesting to see. But he's going to become the driving force. Now, again, Zionism is not his invention, but Herzl has some unique attributes that put him in a position to become the key player. Number one is he's Western European, not Eastern European. Okay, which is very important, coming from a more enlightened part of the world, being very well educated, marrying into a wealthy family, had money, he was a journalist, he had political connections, he was well educated, he was very impressive looking, he was a tall man, everyone's seen pictures of him, they always had the profile with the beard. You know, David Ben-Gurion, as I mentioned, David Green from Plunsk, Poland, met Herzl early on, the turn of the century, and he said that people called him like Moses. You know, very, very uneducated Moses by Jewish standards, but in terms of Jewish knowledge, but he had a bearing and a sort of a regal stature to him that was very impressive. He spoke well, he looked well, he acted well, he knew how to move in the right circles. And he's very, and which doesn't mean, by the way, that he has the backing of all the other Zionists. He's constantly at odds with Eastern European Zionist leaders, as we'll see in a minute. But he's going to rise to a position of prominence. And he, in 1897, is going to convene, in August 29th, 1897, convene the first Zionist Congress. I already mentioned the Katowice Conference that took place previous, but this is the real first Zionist Conference, which was supposed to be held in Germany, but it's held in Basel. Why was it held in Germany? Because in a rare show of unity, the only one I know of, both the Orthodox and the Reform put up tremendous pressure not to have it, for very different reasons. We'll talk about it in a minute. But it moves to Basel, Switzerland. So there's 197 delegates from 16 countries. And in it, and you can read the minutes from what happened, the initial Zionist policy is formed. And this is really the the major event in terms of the reestablishment of the State of Israel, this conference. And there's going to be many other Zionist conferences. When we think of the Basel conference, that's the big one. And I want to just quote you. You know, Herzl said after Basel, he wrote in his diary, it's a great quote. This is from Conor Cruz O'Brien's book, The Siege, which is an excellent book to read on the history of modern Israel and Zionism. This is what he says in this book, and it's very ironic. He says, were I to sum up the Basel Congress in one word, which I shall guard against pronouncing publicly, it would be this. At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. Perhaps in 5 years, but certainly in 50, everyone will know it. 50 years and 9 months later, the State of Israel was formed. Not that Herzl was a prophet, but you can see he certainly put into motion. Sorry?
You say that Herzl was not a prophet, but 9 months spread. I mean, that's pretty good for not being a prophet.
No, he's not a prophet. I mean, clearly. I mean, but he's not. He's not like a Jew. But he clearly had a vision. There's no question the man had a tremendous vision, a tremendous drive. And he works tirelessly. He met everyone. He met the Kaiser. He met the Sultan. He met the Foreign Minister of England. He met Victor Emmanuel. You name it, he met him. He comes in, he meets the Kaiser. He comes to Israel and meets the Kaiser when he's here in 1898, I believe, which is at the same time when they build the Augusta Victoria Hospital on the Mount of Olives. And, of course, the Kaiser kind of blows him off. Herzl tells him, it's a great line. Herzl says to him, you know, we need water. And the Kaiser in Israel says, you guys need water. And Herzl says, yeah, we need a lot of water. It'll cost millions. It'll cost millions of pounds, whatever. The Kaiser says, you Jews have plenty. So it's interesting. Even at that time, they already had an idea that Jews are controlling the world's economy, you know. But unfortunately, Herzl dies in 1904 after, I think it's the Sixth Zionist Conference, has a heart attack and dies. Bankrupt. He spent all his money. He just drove himself into the ground. He really gave his life for the cause. His wife, Julia, who sort of tries to take over unsuccessfully, she dies at age 35. His three kids, it's a disaster story. One of them converts to Catholicism. One of them commits suicide in Washington, D.C. in 1946. He has no direct descendants left. His family is like a tragic family. Really is.
There's no direct descendants.
No, there's no direct descendants of Herzl and Herzl left. They're all, it's terrible. No Jewish descendants. I don't know if there's any non-Jews. There's no Jewish descendants for sure, but then again, his kids weren't Jewish in the first place anyway because of his wife's background. But he's a very interesting character in Jewish history. He gets, and not to spend more time on him, but certainly he served his purpose, and then he's like one of those, you know, there's a certain insects that have a very short lifespan. They come, they do a lot, and they're gone. He came, he did a lot, he's gone. But he certainly puts into motion much of what's going to be the modern state of Israel today. Yeah. There's so much. I can't off the top of my head recommend a bibliography. There's so much stuff written on Herzl. I mean, tons. He's one of the big guys. I'll try and find you. I'll ask for a good source and find out. I'll ask tonight in my tour guide's course. You know, what's the best book on Herzl? He, by the way, his body was brought to Israel. He dies on July 3rd, 1904, but in 1949, right after the founding of the State of Israel, his body is disinterred. He was buried in Europe and brought to Israel and buried on Mount Herzl. And you go to Mount Herzl today, you can see Herzl's tomb. He's up there. And they had a big state funeral. His body was in state, and there was a whole big thing. I want to talk about some of the other personalities that are very important at this time. One of them is Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann, who is 1874 to 1952. He was born in Russia. He was a European educator. He was a chemist. He, early on in his youth, became associated with Chobevi Tzion, the Lovers of Zion movement. And after Herzl's death in 1904, he becomes the de facto practical leader of the Zionist movement. He, by the way, is going to move to Manchester, England, and become a chemist. He is the person who invents artificial acetone, which is the chief ingredient, I think it's acetate, chief ingredient in cordite, which is the chief ingredient in gunpowder. Which enabled, this is of course on the eve, all this is taking place, this is a chemist in England during World War I, which enabled the English to mass produce gunpowder necessary, obviously, for their war effort. Because of this, he becomes friendly with Arthur Balfour. The governor at the time is David Lloyd George, and David Lloyd George's foreign minister was the former prime minister of England by the name of Arthur Balfour. And through Weizmann's, you know, discoveries in chemistry, he gets in very good stead with the British government. Balfour will later say that acetone converted me to Zionism. Now, the whole British relationship with the Jews is one of the most interesting, if you want to study one of the most interesting questions in modern Zionist history, is what the British had with the Jews. It's a very ambivalent relationship. There's a great book I highly recommend, Barbara Tuchman, The Bible and the Sword. Barbara Tuchman being one of the greatest historians in modern history, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. She wrote an amazingly interesting book on the English, the relationship of the English to the Bible throughout history. Very fascinating. But, Barbara Tuchman, T-U-C-H-M-A-N. She's a professor of Jewish woman who died in the 1980s, professor of Jewish history at NYU. She has some fantastic books. Also, I highly recommend, not to get off topic, but The Distant Mirror, which is about Europe in the 14th century, won a Pulitzer Prize, one of the best history books I've ever read. The Bible and the Sword.
March of Follies.
March of Follies. She has tremendous books. The Guns of August, great book about the start of World War I. I have all of her books. She's a fantastic writer. Weizmann, by the way, is going to go on to lay the cornerstone of the founding of Hebrew University in 1918. If you go to the Har Tzafim campus, there's a big painting in the Student Union. You can see a very famous painting, and there's Weizmann and all the big, and Herbert Samuel and all the other people who are, I think Herbert Samuel's there. Not sure. Maybe it's before his time. Better get that straight. Yeah, I think in 1929 when Hebrew U, is founded. He's in the painting, I'm pretty sure. He dies at age 72. By the way, there's a very interesting... Actually, let me hold on. I'm going to tell an interesting story about Weizmann and Arthur Balfour. Another significant leader is Ahad HaAm, whose name is Asher Hirsch Ginsburg. His pen name is Ahad HaAm. 1956 to 1927, he was originally one of the Maskilim, one of these guys who was into Slavic Jewish culture, who becomes disillusioned. He becomes involved in Chibat Zion, the Lovers of Zion. He is sort of a great intellectual, cultural leader of the early Zionist movement, and his whole view of what the Jewish state was supposed to be was not a refuge for millions of poor Jews from Eastern Europe, but rather the place where the modern Hebrew would create a Jewish culture. He wanted to really make sort of an elitist society of educated, cultured Jews to create sort of a modern, secular Jewish paradise in the land of Israel. So he's a very interesting figure. Obviously, one of the most important people, David Ben-Gurion, David Green, 1886 to 1973, born in Płońsk, Poland, very, very significant character. He's one of those great guys, small in stature, but incredibly great in personality. He's a person I would love to have met, like a real powerhouse. Would that we had, you know, a guy like David Ben-Gurion in the head of the Labor Party today. He would be horrified at what's going on in this country. He was by no means the vision of we have of like sort of the leftist political leader that's in Israel today. He was very, very strong character from a religious family, a religious Zionist, early Zionist family. He goes off. He leaves Judaism. He comes here at a very young age, and he really is a classic case of a person who came here very young when Israel was in a very bad state and suffered the tremendous, the poverty and the famines going on, the droughts, and he would not leave the country. He arrived in 1906. In 1915, when Israel was still under Turkish control, which is, by the way, the same time as our Rosh Hashiva's father, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, was here in Palestine, he had to flee, similar time period. They both got in trouble with the Turks, both had to leave, both go to New York. Okay, interesting. Only difference is Rabbi Weinberg's father becomes a businessman and gives birth to several children, including our Rosh Hashiva. But David Ben-Gurion comes to New York and takes a wife in America. He comes back to Israel later. He ends up becoming the head of the Jewish Agency in 1935. And he becomes the first Prime Minister of Israel in 1948 when Israel was declared a state. He reads the Declaration of Independence in the Tel Aviv Art Museum, which we're going to look at. The last thing we'll look at today is the Declaration of Independence of Israel. Hopefully we'll get there. By the way, you notice that all these people take different names. Okay, a guy like David Green becomes David Ben-Gurion. This is all part of the aura of the modern Hebrew that we take upon ourselves. We no longer need the ghettoized names of Europe. We take upon ourselves these macho Zionist names. If you read the great work of Zionist fiction at this time, Exodus, Leon Uris, who, by the way, is a man who has, you know, tremendous writing ability, but boy, does he have it in for Arabs and religious Jews. He hates them like you wouldn't believe. But you read like that the hero of the book is Ari ben Kanan, you know, like these. It's just like this is the whole image. All these guys had to. A guy by the name of Shimon Persky, his name is Shimon Peres today. They had to change it. If you wanted to make it in the mainstream Zionist establishment, you had to take on this new name because this was part of the transformation of your image from the ghettoized Jew of Europe to the modern Hebrew of the land of Israel. This is all part of the image, and all these guys will take on these many very biblical-sounding macho names. Now, the question is, what's the reaction to this whole movement? We see that by this period of time, by the early 20th century, the Zionist movement is overwhelmingly being run by Eastern European secular Jews. Many of them are these Maskilim. The reaction, the Reform reaction is very anti. Reform Judaism, as we see clearly, it's not a great secret why. These were people who were moving totally in the direction of assimilation and being accepted by European culture. Their ultimate nightmare would be the reemergence in European society of a class of Jews who viewed themselves as going back to the land of Israel. Remember the documents we read? We deny Hebrew, we deny national Jewish identity, we are Germans of the Mosaic persuasion. So the Reform Movement is going to be, in terms of its political platform, virulently anti-Zionist until World War II. Then the Reform Movement does a big about face now. Now they're so into it. You read the platform I read you of the, you know, that just came out with last year. We support Aliyah and learning of Hebrew. That's a reaction to the Holocaust. The Orthodox world also, to a large extent, with a few exceptions, is going to be more or less anti-Zionist. For the same reason, out of the same fear that they're going to be very anti-people going to America at the same period of time. And for the same reason that many of the Orthodox leadership was against people leaving Eastern Europe and going to America. This is a place where you go off. You leave Judaism. You leave Torah. Okay? And we and the major, the two big points of opposition we see are the idea of forcing God's hand. That this is like Jews who aren't even God-fearers who are pushing an issue amongst the Gentiles to reestablish a state. It's not our time to do this. When God's ready, he'll do it. I'm not going to go into right or wrong. Okay, and that's interesting issue number one. And the bigger issue is definitely the notion that the vast majority of the leadership of the Zionist movement was very anti-religious. Okay, and Jews who went to Israel lost Torah. And in the mind of the rabbis, it was better to stay in Eastern Europe and keep Torah than go off. And I want to read you. This is Tzadik HaKohen Rabinowitz, who's the Tzadik of Lublin, 1823 to 1900. He's a big scholar, Talmudic leader of Lublin in Poland. This is his, and this sort of typifies the reaction of the ultra-Orthodox world towards Zionism. Just, we surely know that if we were believers and truly trusted in the salvation of the Lord and were observers of the commandments of God, we would even today be dwelling in our holy land. Why did the land perish? Because they abandoned my laws which I put before them. It has already been made clear that the Zionists reject all the commandments and cleave to every manner of abomination. It may be assumed that if the Zionists gain domination, they will seek to remove from the hearts of Israel belief in God and the truth of Torah. They have thrown off their garments of assimilation and put on a cloak of zeal so that they appear zealous on the behalf of Judaism. They are, in fact, digging a mine beneath our faith and seeking to lead Israel from beneath the wings of the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence. That's a pretty harsh statement, as we say, very harsh. But I hate that. If you read what a lot, the attitude of the modern Zionist movement, there's a lot of truth to that. The famous quote attributed to Ben-Gurion, of, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've seen it said in many places, that the Zionist dream will be fulfilled when a Jewish policeman spends all night in a Jewish city arresting Jewish prostitutes. What's the image? The image is of when we achieve normalcy, like everyone else in the world, our own state, with our own national identity, that's normal. That's obviously not the image of, you know, of the traditional Jewish viewpoint, of being a free people in our land and a holy people keeping Torah. And the point being made is obviously is legitimate, the notion that we were thrown out of the land for not keeping Torah. So we have to appreciate, I'm not judging any sides here, but we have to appreciate that there was definitely truth to the fear of Jews going off. And there's definitely, from the traditional Jewish perspective, the reality of our ability to stay in the land is contingent on keeping Torah is very, very true. Now, what the point is, and it's very important to focus on, that if you look at the overall focus of what the early Zionist movement was trying to accomplish, clearly it was to create a national Jew, as I mentioned before, the Hebrew as opposed to the Jew, with a secular Jewish culture, which is why we have reemergence of modern Hebrew literature. Now, granted, my personal opinion, secular Jewish culture is an oxymoron. You know, what is secular Jewish culture? So that's a problem, for sure. And we see 50 years later, 100 years later, how that problem has manifested itself. And we see a lot of problems in the modern state of Israel that have come out of a desire to create something which really never did come into creation. Another very positive side of the Zionist movement was the notion of Jews getting out of Europe and getting back onto the land and working and building a country. All the early settlement we see in the land of Israel is agricultural settlement. You see Jews, Chibat Zion, learning how to farm again. It's not a thing Jews were allowed to do for hundreds of years in Europe. They had to learn how to reclaim the land and build the land. And we see the tremendous number of dozens of settlements springing up at this period of time, late 19th, early 20th century, primarily on the coastal plain, as I mentioned before, where land is available because there's no Arabs living there, and also in the Hula Valley area and in the Galil, a lot of Jewish land is going to be purchased from usually absentee landlords. So there was definitely the idea of the new Jew who takes control of his destiny, creates his a new national identity, reclaims the land, not the passive Jew in Europe, right? Not the Jew who is slaughtered passively, not the Jew who ekes out a meager living, and not even the Jew who's living in the land of Israel previously, who's living off of the charity of rich Jews like Baron Hirsch or Jacob de Rothschild. Okay? Not Jacob de Rothschild, Edmund. And there's no question in hindsight that they got a lot of things moving in the country. There's no question. There's no question in hindsight. And again, I don't want to launch into my too many personal opinions here, because especially on tape, and it will be, no matter what I say, it's going to be used against me. But, you know, there's a certain extreme, there's a very extreme bunch of ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, which is a very teeny tiny minority, which goes so far as to claim that, you know, the modern state of Israel is the work of the devil, more or less. Now, I am a firm believer that everything that happens in Jewish history is in the hand of God. And I firmly believe that my personal opinion, that Zionism was something that appeared and had a specific focus, which was to get the Jewish people moving. There's two great events in the last 100 years that have caused the state of Israel, the Holocaust and modern Zionism. Without one or the other, I don't think it would have had it. One without the other wouldn't have worked. Without the Jews getting our tushies kicked in Israel in the most horrible way in the Holocaust, and without a bunch of people, you know, taking the initiative and making things start moving here, we wouldn't have a state of Israel today. But on the other hand, the great tragedy of the Zionist movement, and you don't have to be a scholar to see this, is Leon Pinsker said it beautifully. The guy who wrote the pamphlet Auto-Emancipation, one of the founding fathers of BILU. He said, we wanted to create a nation of apikorsim. We ended up with a nation of amaratzim, which is we wanted to create a nation of people who were steeped in Judaism, who knew the Bible, like a Ben-Gurion, who could quote a chapter. Believe me, if David Ben-Gurion were beamed, he would win the International Bible Contest, hands down. These early guys, Ravnitsky, Bialik, they knew it. People who knew Torah, who realized that the Jewish roots in the land of Israel, although we're not religious, are based on a Jewish identity that is very old and in the Bible. What do we end up with? You can see 100 years later, at Yitzhak Rabin's funeral, Shimon Peres cannot pronounce a sentence from the Bible correctly. It's a tragedy. My kid, I remember they came home from kindergarten years ago, and one of my kids was singing a little song which says it all. Eretz Yisrael bli Torah kamo guf bli neshama. The land of Israel without Torah is like a body without a soul. And it's the great tragedy. And we see it, and it's so sad that, you know, and when I came in Israel in 1982, they had to do a survey, Jerusalem Post. They asked Israeli high school students, how many of you are Zionists? In 1982, 12% of Israeli high school students said they were Zionists. Now that is far less than half of that. You know the definition of a Zionist today? It's someone who lives outside Israel who gives money to a Jewish organization that gets a third person to come live here, preferably from Russia. Okay? We see a country, and you see what's happened in the land of Israel is in many ways a tragedy, that the country was gutted of its soul, and now you have the modern state of Israel, whereas you had, and you look at the early kibbutz movement. These are people who reclaimed the land, their sweat and their blood, and the stories are unbelievable what these people did, schlepping and draining swamps and malaria and total, and it's really very, if you look at the propaganda of like Russian workers, it's so close that these are people who are very socialist in their attitude, very collectivized, very anti-materialist. Ben-Gurion didn't want television in Israel, it's decadent. And these are people who are really into the work ethic in their own way. The only, by the way, even marginally working example of collectivization we have in human history are kibbutzim, which, by the way, don't work either. They're all going bankrupt. But at least they worked much better than the collectivized farms in Russia, because they were a real bunch of idealistic people who were not materialistic, who were into the ideology, and they built the country. You look at Israel today, on the eve of the millennium, you have people who all they want to do is be like America. The materialism, it's terrible. It's a big, big tragedy. It's the greatest tragedy and that the soul is gutted from the Jewish people. And I don't want to rant and rave about this more. I'm not anti the state of Israel at all. You know, I personally serve in the army. I made Aliyah. It's not my thing here. But one thing we know, and this is when you look at this quote from the Tzaddik of Lublin, he says it very clearly, that we're only allowed to stay in this land if we have a relationship with God, okay, in Torah. And to think we can create a mini version of America here, which is unfortunately to a large extent, if you go to Tel Aviv, what it's become, is a big tragedy. Now, the biggest, you know, if you look at Israeli advertising, the biggest, I would say, compliment you can give to anything is Kamo America, like America. I personally didn't come here to be a little version of America. But just to end with a story, I think it says it all. My sister is an artist. She does art crafts fairs. Maybe you know her, Rafael Shore's wife. She sells little mezuzot, very cute ones with pictures on them.
That's your sister?
It's my sister. I was working at a crafts fair for her in my community a couple of years ago, and we had little mezuzot on display. And a secular Israeli family walks in, And a little kid, about 6 or 7, looks at the mezuzot, and he says, "Ima, maze?" And she says, "Zot mezuzah." She says, "Mommy, what's this?" He goes, and the mother says, "It's a mezuzah." And the kid says, "Maze mezuzah?" And I was like, "Oh my God." That says it all. That you have a Jewish kid living in the land of Israel, doesn't know what a mezuzah is. It's a very scary thing. Anyway, enough of my, that's probably the most personal opinions you'll ever hear out of me in the whole class. But I want to go forward and get to the founding of the state. Let's jump ahead to World War One. Now, World War One, we mentioned before, is a very, part of the whole process of the uprooting of the Jewish community leading to World War II. We talked about that already. But World War One had a big impact on the Jews in the land of Israel. By 1914, there were already 90,000 Jews living in the land of Israel, the population. A lot more Arabs still living here, but a lot of Jews coming back. So we're already into, there's been several aliyot, waves of Jewish immigration into the land. During World War One, as I mentioned, that the basic breakup is the central powers of Germany, Austro-Hungaria, and Turkey. Big stupid mistake the Ottomans make, siding with the Germans, against the Allied powers, Russia, England, France, later the United States. The whole Middle East is under the control of the Turkish Empire, which by the 20th century is called the sick man of Europe. It is a decrepit, rotting empire, just waiting to be blown over. And World War I finishes off the Turkish Empire. It was basically being propped up by the British and the French to keep the Russians from getting into the Black Sea. And God forbid, they were afraid the Russians would get in the Black Sea, then they would have a warm water port to the Mediterranean. There's a lot of interesting things going on that I don't want to get into. But their fatal mistake is to side with the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians. During World War One, from 1914 to 1918, the British are actively involved in getting the local population. Since nationalism has been such a big thing in Europe in the end of the last century and the beginning of the 20th century, the British, it's caught on in the Middle East. The Arabs are starting to get an idea of nationalism. There's no Arab countries then. There's no Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, those are all. They're all just provinces of the Turkish Empire. So the British are actively involved, both with the Arabs and the small Jewish population, in trying to get them, basically as a symbiotic relationship. The British said, "You help us throw the Turks out of the Middle East." And why do the British want to get into the Middle East? Suez Canal, right? They want to have continuous territory going all the way through from Egypt, all the way through to Israel. They want to control it all. This is the British imperialism. The French want to get in on it. Everyone wanted to get in on it. You help us get the Turks out, we'll help you with national self-fulfillment when we get control of the Middle East. So you had people like Lawrence of Arabia, who's running around with Ibn Saud and Prince Faisal. Trying to get the, you could go watch the movie, it's one of the best movies ever made with Peter O'Toole. He's a tremendous character, T.E. Lawrence, great Arabist. Unfortunately, we have a lot of English people who are very into Arab culture. They're going to cause a lot of problems for the Jews. They're going to be very anti-Zionist fulfillment. Another thing you have, which is very interesting, I'm looking for my story here. I may have passed it, so maybe I'll go back and read it. Let me just stop there for a second. Very interesting. The British are also courting the Jews, by the way. And even before World War One, the British are courting the Jews. As a matter of fact, in 1903, this is the story I wanted to mention with Chaim Weizmann. In 1903, after the Kishinev pogrom, you know, Herzl's getting a bit frantic. We got to get these Jews to some place, and there's no place. The British have not come out yet with any commitment to give the Jews a piece of real estate. In 1903, they offered the Jews Uganda. Okay, and Herzl goes for it. Not that that was his ideal, but he realized we got to get these Jews somewhere, and the British are offering us a piece of real estate. Uganda, Kenya is a British territory. They're willing to give it to us. The Eastern European Zionists were virulently against the idea of compromising on anything. We're only taking Israel. We're not taking any other territory. The great quote, the great conversation that takes place between Arthur Balfour, foreign minister, and Weizmann in England is, Balfour offers Weizmann Uganda, and Weizmann says back, "Mr. Balfour, would you take Paris over London?" And Balfour says to Weizmann, but we already have London, meaning you Jews should take whatever you get. Beggars can't be choosy. At which point Weizmann, proud Jew that he is, says, "Mr. Balfour, the Jews had Jerusalem when London was a marsh." That ended that conversation. But David Lloyd George, who became Prime Minister in 1916, this is in the middle of World War One. He gets Arthur Balfour to issue a declaration, which is November 2nd of 1917. The declaration is sent to Lionel Rothschild, the first Jew in the House of Lords, who was a guy who had to reject the position several times because he wouldn't take an oath on the Christian Bible. But this declaration is later known as the Balfour Declaration, which said, and I quote, "His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the establishment in Palestine of a national homeland for the Jewish people," which is amazing, by the way. After 2,000 years of living in diaspora, the British
are offering the Jews a homeland.
Okay, and as to why, it is one of the most interesting topics also. It's part of that big topic of what did the British have with the Jews. It's such an interesting love-hate relationship. On one hand, they love us, on the other hand, they hate us. And there's no question that a British colonial interest played a big part in it. They're dangling a big carrot in front of the Jewish people. A month later, Jerusalem is surrendered to the Turks, by the Turks to the British army. By the way, it happens to be initially surrendered to a British cook out foraging for some vegetables. But there's a great picture of General Allenby, who comes through Jaffa Gate, walks through, goes to the Citadel, where you can enter the Chilhuli exhibit now, stands on where the drawbridge is, and accepts the key to the city. So when World War I ends, the Turkish Empire is divided up primarily between the British and the French, the victorious people. And they create all of these artificial countries that we have today, which make up the countries of the Middle East. And the problem was, in 1922, the original idea of the Balfour Declaration was to give the Jews a huge piece of real estate as a homeland. The Jews would have preferred, like Weizmann, to have the word the instead of a in there, the homeland. The British were being very noncommittal here. But they now found themselves in a position to fulfill their initial commitment. And in 1922 already, the British are given the mandate to rule Palestine, contingent on them fulfilling the Balfour Declaration, okay, which is giving the Jews a national homeland. The problem is, of course, that the British have huge pressure on them from the Arabs because they had to pay back a lot of other Arab leaders. You had Ibn Saud, and you had Faisal, Sharif of Mecca, and all these other guys who we're going to talk about where they're going to all get their own little countries. So what the British do in 1922, they start a process of issuing a number of documents, all of which are going to be called white papers. And white papers were policy papers of the British government, which almost always were anti the Balfour Declaration. There's clearly a British bias against the Jews, and it comes from a number of things. It comes from, first of all, just outright anti-Semitism. It comes from oil, which is going to become a big issue now at this period of time, and the Arabs had it, the Jews didn't. And it's a general attitude that the English have, which is very, very arrogant, by the way, which I want to read. This is a great quote I wrote from Conor Cruz O'Brien. This is a British soldier talking about it. This is because the British were so obviously one-sided towards the Arabs. This is such a great thing. He says, the Jews are so clever, and the Arabs so stupid and childish. It seems only sporting to be for the Arabs. You know, they're just such idiots. They're so condescending towards the Arabs. Those Jews, they got everything. We don't need to help them. And plus, obviously, there's a lot more Arabs in the Middle East. They sat on a lot more property. They had a lot more real estate. They had oil. There's a lot of people like T.E. Lawrence advocating the Arab position. So they're going to embark on a series of official British policy documents that are designed to basically go back on their backpedal from the Balfour Declaration. The first is in 1922. They lop off 73% of what was supposed to be Israel. The original land was amazing. It was like all of what is Israel and all of what is Jordan. Huge piece of territory. They give it to Abdullah, son of the Sharif Hussein of Mecca. Because Ibn Saud got Saudi Arabia, they had to pay back the children of the Sharif of Mecca, Sharif meaning nobleman, descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, who's in charge of the Islamic holy sites. They have to give him some land. So they give him a country which they call Transjordan, which today we call Jordan. Okay? Now, Abdullah, sorry?
What the
sons of... I don't know where they get the trans... I don't know. Sorry? Yeah, right, whatever. And also, we start seeing right at this period of time, within a few years, as the Jews start to come back in large numbers, the Arabs start freaking out. And there's a lot of anti-Jewish riots. In 1929, there's numerous riots. There's in Sfat and in Hebron, about 200 Jews were killed. Okay, and this is going to trigger what is going to be a lot of violence back and forth, mostly Arab towards Jew, but also Jew back towards Arab. In 1939, Malcolm McDowell issues a white paper. This is when Hitler's already in power. This is right before the end of World War II, which is going to limit Jewish immigration to 75,000 Jews over 5 years, which is slamming because the Arabs are putting huge pressure on the Jews. The Arabs are putting huge pressure on the British. Stop letting Jews into the country. So just as the Jews are being locked out of every place in Europe and have no refuge from Nazi persecution, so too Israel is going to be close to them more or less. 75,000 Jews is nothing. This is going to trigger what's called Aliyah Bet, which is the attempt by Jews to illegally run the British blockade and enter the land of Israel, which, by the way, is overwhelmingly successful. I've asked historians, they say about 90% of the Jews actually got through. But the most famous Aliyah Bet story is, of course, the Exodus, which takes place after the Holocaust, that ship. but you have ships crowded with Jews, some of which unfortunately sank. The Jews, the British would capture these ships and send the Jews back or put them in camps. So it was a very nasty situation, especially after World War II. But we see that basically the British have pretty much backpedaled and have closed the doors on Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. In 1936 and 1939, there's going to be the first Intifada in Israel, led by a man by the name of Haj Amin Husseini, who was originally appointed as the Mufti of Jerusalem by the British. They appointed him, but he becomes he's virulent anti-British, anti-Jewish, big Arab nationalist, anti-Semite. He, by the way, is going to flee the British when he leads an intifada in 1936 or 39, in which over 2,000 Arabs are killed, by the way. The British were always condemning Israel today for what's going on here. They leveled Arab villages. They would sit there, any Arab village that wasn't cooperating, they'd bring in a couple of howitzers and just shell the village. They killed thousands of people. They arrested people. Haj Amin Husseini has to flee. He goes to Europe during World War II. He becomes an ally of Adolf Hitler. It's a very famous picture for meeting Hitler. He goes and raises a Bosnian. The Bosnians, those guys, they're not so nice to the Jews, you should know. He goes and raises a Bosnian SS unit for the Germans to kill Jews in the Balkans. And he dies in 1976, by the way, at a ripe old age. But it doesn't mean, by the way, that all the Arab leaders are anti-Jewish. The general Arab attitude towards the Jew is not positive. It comes from an age-old, as we talked about Islam, the view of the pan-Islamic view of the world, Dar al-Harab, Dar al-Islam, that the Arab world is meant to, the Islamic world is meant to control the whole world. That which was Islamic and has now been taken over has to be reconquered. So the notion of any kind of presence that is non-Islamic in the Middle East is going to be unacceptable. But on top of that, the notion that Jews, dini, right, the second-class citizens who've always lived under our thumb, even in the land of Israel for the last 1,300 years, should now be in a position to have any kind of permanent presence outside of Muslim control is unacceptable. So when you combine that with modern Arab nationalism and the fears of being thrown out of their land, which were legitimate fears, there's a lot of Jews coming in here, you get an explosion of anti-Jewish violence, which, by the way, was not... I've met Jews, old Yishuv Jews, who lived here prior to the state. They talk about how there was definitely separation of Jews and Arabs, but there was, you know, but they lived together basically in peace. And there was interaction business-wise. The real hostility only explodes when the Jews come back. And the big rise in the sudden Arab interest in Israel and how important it is going to explode at this period of time. Some other question?
Yeah. You said this is basically a question about, you say there, the Muslims' belief or the Arab belief.
Muslim.
The Muslim belief is that Jews would be under their thumb and everybody, they run the world. Isn't the Jewish belief the same thing in the time of Mashiach?
No, not the Jews run the world. The whole world recognizes God. It's not the same thing. We don't conquer the world. There's no idea of holy war and conquering worlds. There's only the most superficial similarity. Ideologically, yes, we believe our idea is meant to dominate, they believe theirs. They have a very different methodology of how to accomplish it. By the way, not all the Arab leaders were against the Jews. Two very important people, Ibn Hussein, Faisal I, 1885 to 1933, becomes the king of Iraq, 1921 to 1933. Met Chaim Weizmann. He was a smart enough Arab leader to realize that a Jewish presence in the Middle East is great. Having these educated people with great connections is only going to be good for all of us. Shimon Peres would have loved this guy. You know, the new Middle East, this was a guy who had the vision. Another important guy is Ibn Hussein Abdullah. Abdullah, who's from 1882 to 1951, became the first king of Transjordan. They're both the same, Ibn Hussein, the same Hussein Sharif of Mecca. They're both his children. This is the British payoff to both these guys. They gave him two countries. He was very interested in making a peace treaty with Israel in the founding of the state. Okay, he was a very moderate leader. He was assassinated in 1951 on the Temple Mount. He was killed by Muslim fundamentalists. His grandson, Hussein, who just died, the king of Jordan, definitely also a nice guy by Jewish standards, was there. He was saved because the bullet hit. He was wearing a medal or something, and it saved his life. He was hit by a bullet also. And he's the grandson because Hussein's father, Hassan, I think, they're all Hussein Hassan because they're all family of Muhammad, was insane. Hussein was the, and he never became king. So Hussein, it skipped a generation. Hussein becomes king very early on, a young age. He's one of the longest reigning monarchs until he died a year ago. But those two guys, unfortunately, the moderates don't dominate. They're out of power very quickly. Now, what's the reaction of the Jewish world? The mainstream, by the way, Zionist movement has been evolved into the Jewish Agency, which is going to be recognized by the British as the Jewish entity that oversees Jewish events in Palestine. Their policy is one of gradualism, not to push the British. And they suffered. The British would arrest them periodically, but they didn't want to openly antagonize the British. There are other people who take a much more sharp stand and feel that, look, the British are turning their backs on us. They're turning us over to the Arabs. They're negating all their promises. We've got to take a more active role. One of them is Vladimir Jabotinsky, Zev Jabotinsky, from 1880 to 1940. He's also buried lower down below Herzl up there. I don't know if Herzl, if Ben Gurion would be happy that he's up there also. And Ben Gurion's not buried on Mount Herzl, by the way. He's buried in stable care in the Negev, which is an absolutely beautiful place to visit. If you're ever down in the Negev, his gravesite is gorgeous. But Jabotinsky was a Zionist revisionist. He was originally, he's from Odessa, he was a member of the Zionist executive. He breaks off in 1923, feeling that the Zionist movement is too passive with the English, and he founds the revisionist movement that takes a more aggressive stance. Okay, so he's the revisionist. He is the mentor and leader of a person who's going to be very significant in modern Israeli history, Menachem Begin, 1913 to 1992, who's originally from Russia, supporter of Jabotinsky. He arrives in Palestine in 1941 and assumes leadership of the Irgun, which is an underground offshoot defense organization which worked parallel to the Haganah, the Jewish defense, mainstream Jewish defense organization in Palestine, which was defending Jewish settlements. It takes a much more radical approach towards confronting the British and attacking the Arabs, meaning it's an eye for an eye with these Arabs. They're responsible for a lot of bombs and killings. Most important, the Irgun was the one organization in June 22, 1946, blows up one of the wings of the King David Hotel. It was the headquarters of the British Army and the British colonial authority in Palestine. They put bombs in the basement. They warned the British to get out. The British, of course, didn't listen. The hotel blew up, and 91 people were killed. The Irgun, everyone's chasing him around. Even today, they refer to Menachem Begin as a terrorist. You know, he was a tough guy, very tough guy. They took the orders from Jabotinsky. They disbanded in 1948, okay? But this was an organization which sometimes works together with the Haganah, but by 1948 already, all alternative defense movements are going to end. The last one to look at is the Stern Gang, Lehi, which is actually called, Stern Gang is how the people don't like them call them, but the organization was called Lehi, which is Lochamei Chevut Yisrael, which is the fighters for the freedom of the Jewish people, which was led by the most extreme of all, which is Avram Stern, 1907 to 1942. He split with the Irgun in 1940, thinking the Irgun wasn't radical enough. Now, he's captured and killed by the British in 1942. Both the Irgun and Lehi would kill British officers as retaliation for Jews, because the British had prices on the heads of Jews who were underground fighters. You had Jews being executed. They have a very famous story of two Jewish prisoners who were in the Russian compound prison who were supposed to be executed by the British, and a hand grenade was smuggled into them in orange, and they committed suicide by hugging each other and pulling the pin of the hand grenade and blowing themselves up so the British wouldn't have the pleasure of hanging Jews. The Irgun did this amazing breakout in Avako prison, in freeing all the prisoners that the British were keeping there. There's a lot going on of, you know, Arab terrorism, Jews counter-terrorism. There's a lot of violence going on in the land of Israel leading up to. But there's no question in hindsight that the more aggressive approach of the splinter groups definitely played a part in pushing the British to get out of here. I don't know that they would have done it anywhere near as fast. Okay, so those are the main players. Those are the splinter groups. We got to where I wanted to get, more or less. I wanted to get to the Declaration of Independence, which we didn't get to now. But on Sunday, last class, we're going to start with 1948.